So if you have your Bible with you today, you can turn and put your finger in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17. And we're going to look at this big idea today that God has worked specifically to give us a new identity, to transform. When we say gospel transformation in every heart, one of the things we mean is that God has gone to work to change the fundamental element of who we are. And that God worked to give us a new identity, and that new identity leads to a whole entirely new way of living. Who you are is transformed, and it causes us to live a whole new way of life. I met someone this week and explained in conversation with him, I learned that he was a vice president of security, safety, and risk management at a local university, and he oversees all of it. And he went on to describe to me his children, and he said, my oldest is in the Syracuse Fire Department Fire Academy currently, and I have a middle child, and they do this, and my third child is a teacher. And at the end of the brief conversation, he said, it seems I've done a decent job raising them, and I hope that they continue to follow through on where they're at in life. And it occurred to me all over again that when I meet somebody, I start by saying, what's your name? And when I get their name, I immediately change gears to, so tell me, what do you, how do you finish that sentence? What do you do? So get this, in order to discover who somebody is, we want to know their name so we have something to call them, but then in order for us to discover more about who they are, we want to hear what they do. This particular conversation, the gentleman says to me, this is my name, and these are my kids, and he immediately tells me what his kids do in order to help me understand who they were, in hopes also that it reflected well on him. And I don't think this is uncommon. Do you think this is uncommon? It's very common. In fact, I often imagine to myself, what would it be like? Imagine how stunned someone would be if you didn't say, it's a pleasure to meet you, Jim. So instead of saying, what do? You say, it's a pleasure to meet you, Jim. So tell me, who are you? Can you imagine somebody's stunned look like, who am I? Well, I've never had that question asked before. Well, I'm a man. How does somebody answer the question, nice to meet you, who are you? I know I would freak out. Would you freak out if somebody said, who are you? I'd be like, well, I'm a new creation. Of course not. I mean, how do you answer that question? I know what I do. I immediately start to explain to people what I do, what people expect me, the roles, responsibilities that I have been given, that I have adopted, or that otherwise I have been found myself playing, and I define myself based on what I do. And I think it's probably true that most of us define ourselves based on what we do. And it would startle people to ask them not what they do to describe themselves, but who they are. I think it would be stunning. I think we all tend to do that. For most of us, what we do drives who we are. Most of us, and if you think about it, this is so dangerous. We define ourselves by what we do. Can I ask you to think about something real, just briefly? Won't be too much thinking. Don't worry. Just a little bit of thinking. Think about this. What happens if you define yourself based on what you do? What happens when you no longer do that anymore? Right? What happens? If you define yourself by what you do, and let's say you're a student, what happens when you are no longer a student and you're trying to describe to people what you are? You know how I did it? I used to tell people, well, now I'm a graduate, which simply meant I'm unemployed, have no idea where I'm going with my life. If you're a student, what happens when all of those classes are done and now you haven't been employed somewhere? I got another one for you. What if you define yourself by being a mom? And more on a sober note here, what happens when, God forbid, some tragedy takes your child from you, or even worse, they choose to move away as an adult? Then what happens? and they're not around you to oversee and to take care of and to nurture anymore. Listen, if you define yourself as a mom, the question will plague you when you're no longer able to play that role like you did when they were little, because God forbid they're gone or they go away. Who are you? Who are you? Are you lost and wandering and trying to figure out what you ought to be doing? Over the course of time, you probably have met somebody maybe who is a husband, and the husband is coming to terms with who he is based on this idea that his wife has left him, separated, divorced, and he's no longer really a husband, and he's trying to sort out who he is. Or this happens all the time. Somebody who is a vice president, a business owner, an employee, and then through some turn of events, either it slowly has slipped away or they no longer own the business, they're no longer employed by that company, and they're having an identity crisis. If I'm not this, who am I? I still remember when told you the story several times perhaps, or I still remember when I was in between churches and all I knew my whole adult life was pastoring a church, and I was sitting around with about 40 or 50 other pastors, and someone who was leading the meeting had this great idea. Let's go around and tell everybody who you are and what church you're pastoring. And they happened to decide to do that in between, in the phase of my life where I'm not pastoring anyone anywhere. And I remember telling myself, this is okay. I'm not, my identity's not in being a pastor. It's really not. As the room started to move towards me, my heart rate started to go up, and I'm thinking to myself, you are lying to yourself. And I had to stand up and say, my name is Dan, and I'm honored to be called into full-time church leadership and have presently am not leading anywhere at any church, and had to come to terms with the idea that I still have an identity even though I'm not doing anything. And I think we all find ourselves in that position, and I think we all run this risk. You've got this in your notes. Here is the problem. If you've defined yourself by what you do, you have set yourself up for an identity crisis. If we let our jobs, if we let our roles, if we let our relationships define who we are, when we lose them, notice I didn't say if, when we lose them, who are we? Are we anyone? What do we do after that? An identity crisis begins. Who are you when all you can do and all you can produce and all you can manage is gone? And if we trace this back to the beginning, we can blame the people we always blame. Thank God for Adam and Eve. Because at the very beginning, God created Adam and Eve in his likeness, and he said, this is good. And God initiated a relationship with these two where, get this, he defined who they were and he demanded that they do nothing except just be with him. They had been created in his image. They reflected who he was. They were satisfied and gratified in that relationship with the Father. And God said, hey, you don't need to do anything. You can just be my people and my image bearer, but stay away from the tree. And then the tempter comes. And the tempter says, did God really say that? Do you really believe that? Do you trust your Father's word? And secondly, if you eat of the tree, you will become more significant. Your identity will be similar and equivalent to God. How would you like that? And outside of the parameters in which God defined them and created them, they began to look for a new identity, and they had to work, they had to do something to obtain it. And when they did, the scripture calls that the fall. They rebelled, and they broke this bond with the Father that eventually perpetuated itself. And we see here that the origin of our tendency to find our identity outside of God and in our own works, thank God we can blame Adam and Eve. And then we have the same type of inherited seed. Here's what the tempter said. Don't look to God to define you. Don't trust what he says about you. The tempter says, look instead to yourself, look to what you can do, and you can define yourself. You know what? It's not just a tempter in the garden that you and I are plagued with today. We still hear those voices. We're still led by those temptations. We still are driven to define ourselves based on what we do. And this rebellion shattered their identity, and it tore apart their relationship with God, and it tore apart their relationship with each other, and it created the world in which they lived and you and I now live. But it didn't end there. It was passed on from generation to generation. And here's a question for you. What about you? What about you? Think about who you are, how you define yourself. Are you letting someone or something other than God define who you are? Or define what you do? Are you defining yourself? Competing and comparing, proving and promoting yourself and protecting yourself to make sure that you tend to protect and otherwise project an identity that you are someone. Are you looking to your own abilities and your actions to make you who you are? It's funny, sometimes I stand around with people and I meet the family, and the patriarch or the matriarch in the family will help me get to know who their family is. And without fail, they'll start with, "This is my son so-and-so, and here's what they do." And then they'll go to the next person, "This is my daughter, and here's what they do." And around the entire family, it occurs to me that that parent's pride and joy isn't just in having the child and having relationship with the child, but also what the child does for a living, right? Their identity has been shaped in what mom and dad see them, what role they see them playing. So, and then here's another question for you. Are you looking to what has been done to you? How many of you know somebody who has been victimized, and for a long time in their life, they have a hard time overcoming that victimhood because it has defined them? They see themselves as somebody who's been taken advantage of, and they have a hard time developing trust because they believe themselves to be a victim. Understandable, for sure. Everything you do and everything I do, here's where it comes from. It comes out of what we believe about God, what we believe about His Word, and also what we believe about the work that He's done. And the question I have for you today is, what is your identity? And you will do, listen to this, you will continue to do the things that are driven out of who you believe yourself to be. I mean, let me give you an example. How many of you remember, if you have a family, getting up several times in the middle of the night to the point in which you went almost delirious to feed a child because you were a new parent? You remember that? And some of you don't remember that because you purged it from your mind forever. Do you remember that? Let me ask you a question. What would make you get up several times in the middle of the night to do anything except that you were a new parent? How many of you remember signing papers to cause you to borrow tens of thousands of dollars from a bank, and the only reason you did is because you were a new student at a university? And if you weren't a new student at a university, you would have never borrowed tens of thousands of dollars, but if you're a student, what do? You borrow money from the university. And here's what I want you to see, that who you see yourself to be causes most of the behaviors that you yourself are doing. And that goes for all of us. And what I'm hoping you to see here is that there's a solution and there's a life-changing choice that you and I can make. And I want to ask you to consider this today. And we're going to read this scripture text. It's going to redefine who we are. Here it is. Let the God who created you define who you are. Let the God who created you. In the Christian faith, we believe that the God who holds the universe together is also the God who created the human race. And that eventually Jesus claims us back. See, Adam and Eve broke it. We all found ourselves separated from God. But Jesus has worked to bring about a new beginning, a new creation. We call that renewal or restoration. He brings us back into experiencing this renewed identity that we had when we were in the garden. And Paul, the apostle, is teaching his church about it. And here's what he says, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17. Look what Paul says. Paul says, this means that anyone who belongs to Christ by faith and the grace of God, anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. This is what happened to me in the 1970s. I found myself stumbling into being a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. Then God worked on my heart and I left the darkness of the Steelers and I came to the light of the Cowboys. Totally new creation. I renounced and rejected all the dark and yellow, black and yellow of the past. Now I have a new adversary. They wear red, white, and blue. God has taken us from people of self-centered, dark, prideful independence and self-reliance. And here's what he did. In our faith, when you belong to Jesus, he creates someone new who no longer cares primarily what your own heart thinks, but is defined by and is driven by all that God has created you to be and to do. I mean, after all, we are not people who've been created by God as human doings, right? We're human beings. We start with being who we are, and that drives what we do. And God himself has already made you into somebody. Well, what does that mean? It means that you no longer have the responsibility as someone who belongs to God. You no longer have the responsibility of making yourself into somebody. God has already declared who you are. And according to the scriptures here, the old life is gone and there's a whole new life that has begun. And this new life that has begun drives you to do new things and live with different behaviors. And this really is a principle I wanted to introduce you to called the creative authority principle. And that is this principle that whoever creates it has the authority to define what it is and what it does. So to help you better understand this particular principle, I have a couple of items to show you. The first item is this item here. This was created by my children. I won't name the child so as not to, incriminate their... Also, I won't name them because they are copywriting this to make millions off of the prototype and then market it. So I asked one of my children when they made this for us, I said, "Wow, that is fantastic, buddy. What is it?" And he said, "It's a bird." I said, "All right, what does this bird do?" And he said, "Bird things." Makes sense. Isn't that brilliant? That's my wife's side of the family. That kind of brilliance comes from my wife's side of the family. It's just so effortlessly. Then, check this out. This is a little bit more complicated, but I wanted you to see this. Another one of my children made us this. So, you know, when you first look at it, you kind of try to figure out, okay, how does this work? Does this go on the head? Probably not. It's pretty uncomfortable. So I say to my child, "So what is this?" And they said, "Well, this I made as a bowl for chip and dip." And I was so thankful because my wife was using it as an ashtray and all the ashes were falling out of it right onto the carpet. So that clearly wasn't it. Just kidding. My wife told me I had to tell you that I'm kidding when I say those things because she gets confronted after service. Like, "Really? You did that to the child? You put it out in the winter outside overnight?" No. He was just telling a story. So this is a bowl for chip and dip. And here's the thing. My daughter who created this has the authority, because she created it, to define what this is. And based on what it is what it does. And I happen to notice here there's a certain place you can't put the salsa. You can't put the salsa here. And I also started to think, well, maybe the salsa goes here, and then in here is like the next few chips that you're going to go to. So you put them there like they're on deck. You know, and then you hold them in your hand, then you got some kind of stored there. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how useful it is. My point is this. When someone creates something, they get to determine what it is and what it's used for. This and this don't get to tell the creators that created it what it is. And with all of the kind of gender identity confusion, it's such a tense, difficult topic because of how important and how challenging and how deep it affects some people. But one of the basic fundamental principles is this. Here's where we start. It's the creator who has the only real authority to define what or who someone is. And that which is created by the creator doesn't say, "I'm not what you created." And get this. The creator also gets to determine what this creation does and the function in which this particular creation expresses itself. So what is it? The creator defines that. What does it do? The creator defines that too. And so This is where I wanted to show you what God intended to do with us. What does he intend to do with this new creation? What does he intend to do with us who are, the old things are gone and the new has come and we begin to live this new lifestyle and this new life, new priorities, new values, new behaviors? Here's where it comes from. You've got this in your notes. To help make his name famous in the world, God intended to glorify himself everywhere. And we use the word famous, to be well known, to be weighty, to have supreme value and worth. God, to help make his name famous in the world, God causes your image-bearer identity. That means that you and I are primarily responsible to bear the image of the Creator. When they see us, they understand better who God is because we bear his image. And this identity drives a new way of life. New way of life. So get this. It's impossible to live the new life God intended for you to live if you don't embrace the person God intended you to be. It's impossible. And I think there's a lot of different examples of defining that, but let me explain to you what Jesus said. Jesus said, I want to give you this authority that has been given to me to go and make disciples. And then Jesus says something very, very specific. Listen to this. He said, when you're making disciples, here's what I intend for you to do. I intend for you to take these disciples and baptize them into the name in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit. And when they come up out of the water, it's going to represent their new life, their new creation, and also their new mission that they've been given. They're going to do new things. And the baptism idea here is that they would be saturated in a new identity that identifies with the way that God created them and intended them to live. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and of the Spirit. Now this is similar to what happened to our friend Abraham. You all remember Abraham. Do you also know that Abraham wasn't always named Abraham? That there was a period in Abraham's life where he was not Abraham, instead he was Abram. When God spoke to Abram specifically and said, Abram, I recognize that you don't have any kids. I recognize that you and your wife are beyond childbearing age. You are golden oldies. You are senior saints. And I want you to know this. God the Father says to Abram, I am going to declare over you that you will be a father of many nations, and I will make your people great, and they will shine brightly, and they will reflect well. I mean, in other words, they will bear my image, and they will glorify my great name. Now get this. Can you imagine Abram being like, well, what are you talking about? No way. Have you seen my wife? She's not a spring chicken anymore. And not only that, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. Not doing this. And God said, no, this is who you are, and this is what you're going to do. And how does he decide it? By declaration. God declares it. And it's the same power that God created the world and the universe with his word, and then he holds all things together with his word, who ends up being Jesus. But God uses his word to create, and then he uses his word with Abram to recreate, and now it's Abraham. He has a new identity, a new name, and if you belong to God, like Abraham, you, and specifically, you don't have to work hard any longer at acquiring an identity. God speaks it to you. You don't have to try to cover up shame and shortcomings and failures and flaws because you're not unemployed and you're not flunked out and you're not a victim. You're none of that. When you belong to Jesus, he's declared who you are, an image bearer. And you radiate and reflect all that God is by the way that you use creativity and love and affection and all the other things that help us to see who God is and remember the way he has worked. It also means that you don't have to hide when your work doesn't measure up. You don't have to bluff and tell people what they want to hear or what they might be impressed by. We don't have to cover our shortcomings. You remember what Adam and Eve did to cover themselves up? They had to work to create some kind of leafy covering for themselves. They had to, again, do their own work to cover their own failed and flawed identity using their own effort. So God has worked. He has done something to give us a new identity. And this new identity leads to a whole new way of life. And your new image bearer identity drives a new way of life. What we do because of who we are. Who my creator says I am, that's how I live. So with this new life, I have a new identity and I have new things that I do. Now most of us, because we see ourselves as a business owner, mom, dad, husband, wife, child, student, employee, executive, or whatever, normally, because we see ourselves that way, those are the areas in which we pour ourselves into and we do those things based on our roles and our responsibilities. What I'm trying to invite you to consider is this. What if that's not primarily who you are, so those aren't primarily the things you do? What if those are the things that you do in order to help you live in the with the express identity that God has given us? In other words, you're an employee, a student, and a parent in order to provide a means by which God uses your identity to reach, to radiate, and reflect all that He is to the people in your job, in your school, in your neighborhood, in your family, and so on. What if those things that we have made supreme and the primary drivers of our life are simply a margin in our life? It's the shoulder of the road, but the primary road that we're living on is defined by God, new creation, and we adopt new behaviors that drive everything in our lives. Let me explain what I mean. You have this in your notes. We are a family. This is what happens to us when we have saving faith, when God regenerates us, or we call this, and you've heard this, this phrase has been much maligned and in some cases rightly so, but this is called being born again. When you are born again, you are brought into a new family, a spiritual family called the family of God. This is what happens. We are, when we're regenerated we call it saved by God, our soul is saved. We become a part of a family of missionary servants. This is our primary identity. This is who God created us to be. This is the way we worship Him. We are a family of missionary servants sent as disciples who make disciples. So who am I? A family of missionary servants. What am I supposed to do? Make disciples who make disciples. That defines me, and that also directs me. So when someone says, well, who are you? I mean, we all know we don't drop this on them, right? Conversation's over. It reminds me every time I sit on a plane. Have you ever heard these preachers tell the story how they sit on the plane, and as soon as they sit down, someone turns to them and says, I just feel an overwhelming urge to ask you this question. What must I do to be saved? And the preacher tells the story, so I opened the Bible and rays of sunshine beamed down and they were transformed. They began to weep. You ever heard those stories before? I'm like, that never happens to me. What is wrong with me? You know how it goes for me? We have this great conversation because I'm a social person. I don't mind talking a little bit. I won't take up all their time because they're probably going to sleep and stuff. So I have a great little warm conversation. And then finally it gets to, so tell me, Dan, what do you do? Well, I actually pastor a church. Hello? Hello? Conversation's over. Blankets up, turn their head, put their armrest down, turn their back to me. Conversation over. And this perpetuates itself over and over again. Every couple of times I meet somebody, I realize as soon as they find out what I do, the conversation is shut down. You know why? Because the preacher is here, and they are expecting who knows what from the preacher, and I believe that's probably why. I don't think it has anything to do with my breath, but it might. Primarily, it's because they expect I'm going to lay that preacher stuff on them. Here's what we have to remember, that we are someone who has something to do, and that's primarily the way God's made us, to be a part of a family. What does that mean? That means that when your family is broken down to pieces, it doesn't mean you're family-less. God has provided a new family as someone who is a new creation, and we are children of God who live and care for each other as a family. That means you have a role to receive care, and you have a role based on who God's made you to be to contribute care in the family. I can't tell you how frustrating it is to have people who have so much to offer and watch them be takers instead of givers in a family relationship. Frustrated for them, because they have so much to give and so much to offer. And by the way, do you remember when Jesus says, hey, listen, here's how the world out there is going to know that you belong to me in here. Do you know what he says? It's your love for one another. It is winsome for the family of God to love each other gracefully and graciously. It's winsome to be a family. Anybody, any of you remember growing up, and there's always kind of a family in the neighborhood who hosts everything, and the teenagers all spend all their time there, and there's always like a limitless buffet, day or night. You can always kind of drop in on them. I remember people like that in my neighborhood, and I always thought to myself, I don't know how I got stuck with my family, because I wouldn't mind being in that family. God's created us as a church family to be the kind of people where people on the outside wish they were on the inside. And by the way, I should point out, when I say outside and inside, I just mean that figuratively. I don't mean to say outside or insider. I mean to say people who don't necessarily share our faith find it winsome within the body and within the family, okay? So secondly, we are missionaries, which means we have a primary role, a God-given role, because of who we are as missionaries, to be sent. God has sent us himself to restore all things to himself. So one of the primary things that we do, based on the primary identity that God has given us and declared over us as a missionary, is to be a part of restoring people and things that are broken and separated from God back to the Father. We are restoration people. We are ambassadors. We are reconcilers. And God sent his Son to earth, and he takes on human form, and he lives within the culture. He worked, and he ate, and he interacted among the people, and he lived in such a way that those around him could see and experience what God was like based on the way he lived his life. In the same way, we believe that we are missionaries and we are sent into our culture, our workplaces, our classrooms, our neighborhoods. We are sent people who are sent to restore all things to God through Jesus. And we have to be so careful that as missionaries that we don't see ourselves as being sent to tell people how to live a more moral life. Morality is the fruit of spiritual maturity, but it isn't our primary message. And I can tell you, a couple times a week, I thank God that our primary message isn't, hey, you got to shape those morals up. Our primary message is that despite your immorality, God has created you to know him, and he graciously forgives you upon your faith, and he makes you a part of his family. Thirdly, we are servants. We are servants of God who serve others as a way of life, as a way of life. Our bosses, our coworkers, our classmates, our neighbors, when they meet you, one of the things they primarily discover is they've met a servant who empties themselves of what they desire, want, and need, and they elevate the needs of them, the other person. Why would we do that? Because that's a primary character trait or primary change in identity that God has transformed us into. Jesus took on the posture of a servant. Here's a word for you. Jesus emptied himself, and he demonstrated to us what emptying himself looks like, even to the point of death. So all those who follow Jesus are called to serve in and with the same humility. For this is the means to joy. This means joyful serving whomever God brings into our life. So listen, when I invite you into a small group of people to share your life, to be a family who lives to meet the needs of other people and to restore the neighborhood and the neighbors back to God himself, when that opportunity comes in the weeks ahead, as you can imagine, I don't want to drag anyone into these environments. I don't want to have a sign-up list and then have to spend a sentence or two sentences or a paragraph or a half hour convincing anyone, talking anyone into anything, or otherwise coercing or squeezing somebody to sign up so that we can enhance our small group program. Instead, what I'm hoping is going to happen is when the opportunity presents itself, I'm hoping that something ignites inside of you and you say, that's how I desire to live, and those are the kinds of people I want to live with and close to, and that's what I want to do with the people who love me and who I love. And then, imagine this, then when this opportunity presents itself, it's a gospel community who lives on mission to restore the neighbor and the neighborhood to themselves, to God himself. when that opportunity presents itself, what I'm hoping for is that there's something appealing, attractive, way down deep inside where we say, all these other things I've been doing, I'm willing to marginalize those things. We still have to do them. But those things are going to become the mission field in which I do them. My primary identity is going to be lived out through living with people who are on mission to reach people who are far from God and to restore things that are broken to pieces. And as you can imagine, I don't want to talk anyone into it. I don't want to say, hey, we want to make sure we have a nice, healthy sign up. In fact, I want you to do what appeals to your very new nature that God has given to you, to dwell and to do. Dwell with each other. Be in a family of missionary servants who do the work of restoration, finding people disconnected, disheartened, down, and be a part of the way God reaches them and brings them back and experiences love and care, affection and purpose and forgiveness. All the things that we enjoy together. So I hope you hear me today when I invite you to let God define who you are and let who you are drive the things that you prioritize and the things that you do. Do you pray with me, Father?